This is listener-supported public radio for Acadiana. KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Like us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest in the studio, artist and writer Dennis Ward. Dennis Ward has passed most of his working life as a respiratory therapist, computer systems engineer, art gallery owner, and artist. One day, he was honest enough to accept the lie, was more in tune. I'm sorry. I should have glasses on today. One day he was honest enough to – did you know that you were living a lie, Dennis?
No, I didn't.
One day he was honest enough to accept that he was more in tune with the artist's way of life than the world of bits and bytes in that computer world, a decision he's never regretted. And this is the part where he's also very funny. He has a good sense of humor. He tells people, I'm truly grateful to have the opportunity to write novels, stage plays, short stories, and poems at an age when I have more hair growing out of my ears than on my head. So on that note, welcome, Dennis Ward.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Let's talk about living that lie, huh?
Right.
You know, Dennis, it's interesting for me to have you in here today because I've known you for quite a while now, actually. I'm not sure how long, but it's been a while.
About 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah, at least. And I knew you first as a visual artist, as a mosaic artist.
That's right.
Working with clay.
Masketeer.
And doing masks and all kinds of wonderful pieces. Let's go back a little bit. Life for you started in the state of Michigan.
Right.
Did it? Right?
Yeah. I was raised in Michigan. And in 1975 – when I was 18, I left. I went to the University of South Florida in Tampa.
And that's how you ended up in the South.
Yeah. And after school, I moved to Atlanta and lived there 16 years.
Okay. And from Atlanta, you came to Louisiana?
A little jog. I was living in the North Georgia Mountains.
Okay.
On the border of North Carolina.
That's right.
And I moved to the South. I wanted to be close to the Delta, the blues, the music.
Yeah.
I was already down here in a number of galleries, and one thing led to another, and I was living here.
Yeah.
I said I'd give it 2 years, and I've been here over 16 now.
You know, and it's interesting, you know, I want to talk about you as a visual artist because you did some wonder, and you still do, but when you were really focused on that, putting out more pieces, you know, your focus now in the arts is
writing.
With writing. And I'm curious about having been a visual artist, that transition from going from that to what you're doing now in writing.
I was kind of forced by a medical condition I have. I have a severe essential tremor, and I just couldn't paint anymore. I couldn't sculpt or paint, and it was getting worse, and it was becoming more difficult to do what I love to do, and I had put writing on the back burner for a number of years. And
so writing was something you had done earlier?
Yes, yes. I had dabbled with that's one thing, all those folks who are making little notes on scraps of paper, save them, because that's what I did. And eventually they worked into short stories and plays and novels.
I'm curious, where did they go, Dennis? Did they go into a drawer? Did you have a box?
Well, yeah, I never threw anything away.
Yeah, yeah.
Those third grade report cards may become. But anyway, yeah, I saved those little scraps of paper and little gems I would hear observing people as a craft.
Yeah.
And listening to dialogues and capturing voices in your head and imprinting them on your mind later for the dialogue in stories.
Yeah.
And plays.
You're at parties or gatherings and you're taking notes.
Mentally.
There. Yeah. Mentally. Yeah. You know, I always remember when I first got to know Maureen Brennan. With Cite, I would see Maureen very often in the cafe part come in and grab a napkin. And she would just start writing down. And it was something she had heard that sparked an idea or what a great character she had just met. You know, but she always had these napkins with those notes that you're talking about on, you know. And it's interesting now you hear a lot of people use – do you ever use your cell phone for that?
No, not really. I can be standing in line at the grocery store or gardening in my front yard, and I love to listen to people and how they relate to one another and what they're saying and what their little mini world
is. Yeah, yeah.
And all those combined for little dramas that work into stories were – we're constantly being surrounded by that type of thing in our lives. And if you're observant enough and you can hear a unique voice, it's a gem to me, to meet somebody who speaks with a language that's unique. I was having lunch with an old friend the other day, and she was just describing that she was surprised. And at the end of the sentence, she said, and Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, to describe her joy.
Oh, Lord.
And I thought that was such a colorful way to express joy.
Yeah. You're going to say that's going to show up somewhere.
Oh, yes.
You know, I find myself, Dennis, wanting to – there are some earlier things I want to talk about, and then I also want to talk about writings that you have been focusing on. And what I'm finding is that some of the writings you have been doing recently focus on the earlier days. And so I'm going to tie some of those in. You have done – and I want to let people know, too, to find out more about – what Dennis is doing, you can go to Dennis Ward, that's WARD, author.com. And also you can find Dennis on Facebook. But we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about the book that you wrote, Mademoiselle Gigi, and you have a production coming up that opens Thursday, March 27th at Cité des Arts, Chez Giselle, which is all about the same fascinating woman. But prior to that, I want to talk about some of your other individual pieces. And
okay.
That takes us back to some of the earlier days. It's interesting because I'll have artists on here, and just recently, I think when Trish Ransom and Laurie Henderson were on, and they were discussing making the decision in their life to leave the careers that they were doing, which were secure in terms of the paychecks that they were getting consistently, and it's work they had been doing for a while, so they were very comfortable in it, and making that decision, I'm going to pursue art full time. And everything that went through their minds and what they had to go through to make that process happen. You're also somebody who did that in your life. And there's a piece that you wrote called Planet Claire that addresses some of that happening. Your background initially was you worked in the computer industry and as a respiratory therapist.
Right.
And when you decided to make a change, you were in the computer world.
Right.
What were you doing at that time?
I worked for a engineering company that wrote software and actually manufactured hardware for microsystems to mainframe communications, and it was in the world of IBM SDLC. If anybody understands,
yeah,
it was all precursor to the internet.
Sure.
How computers talk to each other and local and wide area networks. And I can't even believe I'm that person today that did that geeky stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, it had its advantages at the time because I traveled to different places for the company and got a free airplane ticket to see quite a few landscapes that were different.
Yeah.
Than I was Europe being one and the West Coast a lot, Australia. So that was great.
And I'm guessing, too, that some of the experiences you had during that part of your life really affect some of what you're writing about now. I mean,
definitely Europe. Yes, definitely Europe. Because when you go and live in a place and work with people and make friends, it's a lot different than being a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
And I even had relationships abroad that didn't work out long term because there was a big ocean in between.
That's right. That's right.
But you know, when you live abroad, that's even just getting to know. I still write to the families today.
Yeah,
and we are good friends and have communicated over 20 years. So 30 years.
You put some roots down there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, the piece you wrote, Planet Claire, can you tell us a little bit about that piece?
Well, I was working, as I said, in the communications field. And I was about at the end of my tether with that career. And I had started doing my own art. I was doing furniture art, painting, making and painting furniture, designing it. And I was meeting a lot of artists and living kind of just out of the world of bits and bytes and being more attracted to the artist's life. And I was kind of...
What was attracting you to that? What seemed attractive to you?
The creativity, of course, and the expression of being able to create my own work and seeing so many other wonderful artists' work. And so I happened to find this space that was in Atlanta. It was on the edge of downtown Atlanta, which was before the Olympics, before Atlanta got hugely,
what is now?
Yeah, huge real estate prices. It was cheap rent. And I found this interesting building that looked like the cartoon Jetson family lived in. Had 45-degree angle windows. And I made an art gallery out of it.
What was it initially built for, do you know?
Oh, it had been a series of things, from a plumbing business to a church.
I mean, I wonder the person who built it, they just had vision of...
It was just somebody's vision that probably loved the Jetson cartoons from the 60s.
Yeah,
because that's exactly what it looked like.
Hmm.
I enhanced that with purple neon in the windows and put mannequins with beehive hairdos in. And it was named Planet Claire after the B-52 song.
Yeah.
I had permission. I had met them, and I had permission to use that name.
Ah, okay. Interesting. So you made sure, yeah. Then you made sure you went and asked.
So one thing led to another. The gallery just quickly happened. Overnight, from the University of Georgia.
Had you quit your other job?
Yes, by then. And
was that scary for you at all, Dennis?
Well, I went back into my first career as a respiratory therapist, which was the backup until the gallery had legs.
Okay.
And I met some wonderful artists from the University of Georgia Art School, and that's where a lot of music in Georges made the Athens scene.
Yeah.
It was very prolific in those years of the 80s.
Yeah.
It was a very, very fun place to be.
Oh, I can imagine.
Between Atlanta and Athens. And so, met a lot of musicians, a lot of artists, and pretty soon we started having band album release parties and little
at your gallery, yeah.
Little vignette plays, and it all started happening really quickly.
And how long was that place open for?
Let me think. About 5 years. I suffered an accident. I had bought a house in the North Georgia Mountains, and I actually fell off the second floor roof line on a day that I was cleaning the gutters. And wasps flew into my face, and I fell off the ladder, and I had a serious accident. I was in the hospital quite a while. So I had to give up the gallery.
Okay.
And when I recovered, I moved to the mountains. I had this wonderful home, second home. And it was in a little burgeoning art town called Dahlonega.
What's the name of it?
Dahlonega, Georgia.
Okay.
It's about an hour north of Atlanta. Beautiful, beautiful place. And I met these potters, and we started this pottery group called the Blue Ridge Vortex. And we started having art shows at our house, and they were very popular. And one thing led to another. I was full-blown potter and doing...
Working with clay.
Yeah.
So that's when that started for you, the whole process of working with clay.
Yes.
Okay. All right. For people to read these, like what we're just talking about, Planet Claire, which really tells that story of your transitioning time, are those on your web? I don't remember if those were on the website.
Those stories,
right?
Yes.
Right? Okay, so people can go to that.
They can read excerpts.
Okay, yeah, because that's a fabulous story. The other one that I had the opportunity to read was Higgins Lake. And that takes us back even further in your life.
In my childhood.
Yeah.
In Michigan. Michigan, when I grew up there, I had very little appreciation for how beautiful it was. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's
this
gorgeous.
This place was so incredible. It's so pristine with glacial lakes that are like 100 feet deep. And they're crystal clear. And that's how I grew up in the summers. One of the most beautiful lakes in the world is Higgins Lake. You can look down and you think you're seeing the bottom, and when it's 200 feet deep.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had this blue trailer called the Holly. And we would spend our summers on Higgins Lake. And I wrote that little story. I was about 9 or 10. In those days, you could camp for $2 a night.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
And it was fabulous.
And you got electricity for that, too.
That's right. You had a communal bathhouse, but that was no problem.
Yeah.
And I met a little friend. We started this little minnow business. We would capture minnows from a creek and sell them to fishermen for a quarter, buy our candy.
And a quarter, though. You got a lot of candy back
That's
then for
right.
a quarter.
That's right.
You know, it's interesting with these two pieces, especially, Dennis, in your writing, there's great life lessons in both of these stories. You know, the first one we discussed with Planet Claire, you know, really that whole when people make a transition in their life, whether that transition is moving to a new part of the country, that transition is switching careers. It really addresses that. This other one we're talking about right now, Higgins Lake, the part that really stood out for me is the young friend that you met during that time. He came from the big city of Detroit. Right near Detroit. And he was able to do all kinds of things that you didn't when you were growing up.
To me, being in Detroit in those years, it wasn't the city it is now. but it was fabulous to be near the Detroit Tigers, to be close to the zoo, Greenfield Village, all those wonderful tourist things to a kid were just amazing.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a little farming village where, you know, the grain silo was our highlight of our time.
Yeah.
So, in the arc of the story, but it changes because he comes into my world.
That's right.
And he starts seeing a world that's different than his. And I think at that point our friendship meets. We're equals.
And you know, it's so – I think what you captured really well in this piece was what young boys of that age, how you grab somebody's attention. And it was like, hey, you want to go see a dead mud puppy? You know, but that's what little kids do. How cool is that? Let me go show you that, you know?
Right.
You did a really – I think you captured that really well about how kids that age interact with one another. That's how you grab somebody's attention, especially a young boy. Let's go show you something, you know, dead fish.
There's one thing I'm blessed with. This is a pretty good memory.
Yeah.
I remember those. I've compartmentalized my little life tidbits and extracted them into the story. So,
you know, and it's interesting because how that story comes around then, your family, you end up being friends with, invite his whole family over to eat, but with him, and he goes fishing with your family. And there's a line in there then when it's this young boy talking to you, he says, Greg told me later it was the best time he ever had in his life. I was stunned to hear him say that. Here's a guy who practically can hear the crack of a Tiger home run bat from his backyard saying a fishing trip was the grand moment of his childhood. You know, but that ties that all together.
It frames it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think that's for... That's just a good life lesson, no matter what age you're at, that, you know, sometimes you look at somebody else's life and why would they think what I'm doing is interesting, you know?
And as adults, we can carry that through our adult lives as well. I've been blessed in my life to know so many people that have taken me by the hand and given me their gifts. And I hope I always pay it forward.
Yeah, exactly. This piece that you did, Higgins Lake, that got some notice for you.
That was published in 2012 in Legends. It's Gray Wolf's publishing house's anthology of selected writers. It was selected in their seasonal anthology.
And was that the first time that you had a piece, you know, a piece that you wrote like that published?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You hit it.
What was that experience like for you?
Well, I had to go to Detroit in the dead of winter to a book launch. And that day that I arrived, I used to live in Detroit. And so it was pretty shocking to see how badly the city had declined. And there was a blizzard that day, 3 feet of snow, and I think it was -6 for a high. But
that was a life you knew at one time.
Yeah, Michigan people, they cast that off like it's a sunny day.
Yeah.
The actual book launch, I thought there might be two people, but it was packed.
Yeah.
They just...
Well, that's what people know, you know. I mean, I'm not far. I used to live not far from there, too. And, you know, when that's what you know, that doesn't faze you at all.
That's right.
You know?
They have their big tires on their big trucks.
That's right. You know, so, I mean, Dennis, that's a big stepping stone for you, you know, in your career now as a writer.
It's a bit of confirmation that particular publishing house went on to publish two more stories that were self-contained short stories from my novel, Mademoiselle Gigi. So that was a great honor also that they felt like I had the prowess as a budding emerging novelist to carry on in their tradition of collected short stories and personal essays. I was very honored.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very nice. We are going to take a short break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your book that you have put out, Mademoiselle Gigi, and also the upcoming production of Chez Giselle that will be taking place at Cité des Arts. And a cut of music we're going to hear is going to lead us into the discussion about the book. And let's do – should we do the Monument? I'm going to let you say the
– Monument de Saint-Jean.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got connected to that song?
I actually first heard the song in 1980 in Francois Truffaut's movie The Last Metro in Paris. It was a movie that was set in World War II. And so I researched that song because it was a very haunting melody from the movie. And I found out that that song carried the French people through the war. Mm. That you could be maybe going down any street of Paris or any rue in any little village, and you would hear that movie floating out of
a
window.
That song?
You
yeah.
would hear that song floating out of a window. Being played on a radio. It really sustained the French people. It was probably a bit of escape, but it's a love ballad. It's about a young girl who goes to a musette, which is a small dance hall, and she meets her love, and, well, one thing leads to another. They fall in love, but it doesn't work out. It unravels. And actually, that is Mademoiselle Gigi's story.
All right. And this is being performed by Lucienne Delisle?
Right.
Okay. We'll be back shortly.
Je ne sais pourquoi j'allais danser à Saint-Jean au musette, mais il m'a suffi d'un seul baiser pour que mon cœur soit prisonnier. Comment ne pas perdre la tête, serré par des bras audacieux, car l'on croit toujours aux doux mots d'amour quand ils sont dits avec les yeux. Moi qui l'aimais tant, je le trouvais le plus beau de Saint-Jean. Je restais grisé, sans volonté, sous ses baisers. Sans plus réfléchir, je lui donnais le meilleur de mon être. Beau parleur, chaque fois qu'il mentait, je le savais, mais je l'aimais. Comment ne pas perdre la tête, serré par des bras audacieux, car l'on croit toujours aux doux mots d'amour quand ils sont dits avec les yeux. Moi qui l'aimais tant, je le trouvais le plus beau de Saint-Jean. Je restais grisé, sans volonté, sous ses baisers. Mais hélas, à Saint-Jean comme ailleurs, un serment n'est qu'un leurre. J'étais folle de croire au bonheur et de vouloir garder son cœur. Comment ne pas perdre la tête, serré par des bras audacieux, car l'on croit toujours aux doux mots d'amour quand ils sont dits avec les yeux. Moi qui l'aimais tant, mon bel amour, mon amant de Saint-Jean, il ne m'aime plus, c'est du passé, n'en parlons plus. Ne m'aime plus, c'est du passé, n'en parlons plus.
Right. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange with Cheryl Castile. My guest in the studio today is writer and artist Dennis Ward, here live at Cypress Lake Studios on the campus of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, which we are a public service of. This is KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web, krvs.org. You can like us on Facebook and follow us there on KRVS Public Media. Also, we are listener support. So once again, tip of the hat to all those who continue to assist us in keeping the quality of programming that we do have at this station, both locally and nationally produced programs. You can go to the website there. It's very easy, safe and secure. Donate button, click it, and you can continue to help us out. So Dennis Ward, that song that we just heard, it's such a, you know, I don't know what the words meant, but it's such a beautiful melody that leads us into talking about a couple of really big projects that you have had going on in your life, and they all center around one woman, and Giselle Gigi, and her last name, Carenton?
Carenton.
Okay. And originally from Paris.
Right.
Okay.
She was born in Paris.
And how did you become connected? Because from knowing her in her life, Dennis, you have written and put together a theater production and the first book about her, a second one on the way. Quite an amazing, amazing human being. And how did she come into your life, or you came into hers?
In 2001, I was doing an art show, hanging an art show at a French restaurant in Burbridge. And this woman arrived in her car. She was a tornado. She got out. She was stylish, animated, vivacious. I knew she was French right away, talking with her hands. And she came into the restaurant, and I said, "Who is she? I've got to meet her."
How old was she about at that time?
She was somewhere in her 70s.
Okay.
And I said, "Well, we'll sit down and break bread together." And so we had a four-hour French lunch with bouillabaisse and champagne.
Yeah.
In the French style. And so that started it. We started a deep friendship. She loved art. She had been trained at l'Académie des Beaux-Arts de Lyon during the war. And she was a muralist, an oil painter, a supreme. She had really done a lot, been prolific during her life. So she was an accomplished artist and understood art history. And I had just begun to learn French, so the timing was perfect
sure.
in this meeting. She spoke French with an old-style Parisian accent, which is very distinct from today because a lot of Parisians speak a kind of like slang and it's very fast. But she spoke very understandable French, and it was lovely.
And she ended up here. She married a Cajun gentleman from this area that she met. He was a soldier.
That's right.
During World War II.
After World War II, she met Gerald Bertrand from Opelousas, and they quickly fell in love, and they were married in Paris. And then he was sent back to the States. And her idea of America was by the American movies that she had seen in Paris. And everybody was rich. Everybody was glamorous. So before she left Paris, she went out with her mother and bought a wardrobe of the finest Parisian couture and arrived in Opelousas, hoping she'd be as glamorous and as presentable as any woman in Opelousas.
Sure, yeah.
She got a little bit of a surprise.
Because any place in America at that time, it doesn't matter where you would have gone, there's a mix.
That's right. She had no
idea. You had those people who did dress that way all the time, but you...
I really don't think she understood, like a lot of Europeans, how vast landmass our country is.
Yeah.
So when she arrived in New York, she thought she would take a train and be in Opelousas in a day.
Yeah.
And it was almost like a week.
Sure.
So, but the sequel...
And this was in the 40s?
This was in the spring of 1946.
46. Okay.
That she arrived. Gerald was supposed to meet her in New York and didn't send a wire or telegram or anything. It just wasn't there. So she had a choice. She could have gotten back on the ship, but she chose to plunge ahead into her new life. And she and another girl, war bride, who was starting her new life in Texas, they took the train to Louisiana.
And her next chapter started.
Right. Which starts my second book.
You know, and we're talking too about, you know, the theater production, Shea Giselle, that opens this, not this Thursday, but March 20th. Yeah, this Thursday,
that's
March 27th at Cité des Arts here in downtown Lafayette. She played quite a significant role for a lot of people here in the Acadiana area, and especially in the Lafayette area.
Yes. She had a club, Chez Giselle. It was in two locations. The first was the first floor basement of the Gordon Hotel. It was a small bar, and she quickly outgrew that and found a club on the Abbeville Highway. It was formerly the Al Terry Club, country and western singer Al Terry.
Okay.
It had a capacity for 500 people, so she really developed her shows. They were all types of cabaret acts. Actually, Michael Doucet and Beau Soleil had their first performance at Chez Giselle.
And they played there. And Clifton Chenier played there, too.
Yes.
So she did all, okay.
So there were, of course, drag queens doing female impersonation shows.
And this was what years that when she opened the large club?
1970.
Yeah, that was right. Okay.
And... That club was very popular. It actually drew people from New Orleans and Houston. And there was a murder at the bar, because at that time there was a lot of hate crimes, and there was a politician who...
And hate crimes, and we're talking about this club, really, the clientele attracted a lot of gay men.
Right.
At that, yes.
Right.
Okay.
It was primarily a gay club.
Okay.
Yeah, the story is that there was a murder. It's still a cold case today, but it was a significant turning point for Giselle. And the story is told in my play, Chez Giselle.
And she, she became, she really was a civil rights activist and leader for a lot of the gay individuals here in this area. She did a lot to fight for them, to protect them.
I've seen pictures of the bar inside. There were black, white, straight, gay. And this wasn't too long after civil rights for black people. So, yes, she was all embracing. And it didn't matter what your nationality or sexual preference or anything. If you came in and you were welcome. But she did have to eventually make the club private because there was quite a few gay bashings and bad things that were going on. So she had to protect, because in those years, you could lose your job if you were outed. You could lose your family. And so the climate was such that she felt like she had to provide a safe haven. And some she even took into her home and who were just discarded by their families.
And, you know, the one thing when you read the book that you did, and if you've seen the first production you did of Shea Giselle and you've just listened to you talking about her, the sense of humor was
monumental.
Was right up there for her.
She had a monumental sense of humor, really loved to joke and clown. And later when I was writing the book, I found that this tradition really was developed in her family. She came from a family who were actors and comedians who had performed in the Folies Bergère of Paris. And so I imagine their family life was just a riot.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a line from the book, Mademoiselle Gigi, where it has always, and this is being said to her, it has always been the tradition of our family to pass the gift of humor and lightheartedness to each new generation.
Right. And I've seen that in three generations of that family.
Interesting.
Her sons have been so supportive. I wouldn't have been able to write the books. They're not memoirs. They're historical fictions based on the tenets of her life. Giselle didn't talk too much about the war to her family or to me. So when I started writing, I discovered old letters, photographs, and they were going back as far as the 40s.
Hmm.
And I actually had the great fortune to meet octogenarian people that had survived the war in Paris. And they still had good memories. And we visited the place where Giselle hid and lived for 4 years during the war as a young Jewish teenager.
And people thought, I mean, looked at them, her, I think, it sounded like it gave her, provided them a little bit more of a difficult time because people saw them as this rich Jewish Parisian family.
Right. In 1940, when they fled, when the Germans came into France, the family got in their touring car, which would be now like a Cadillac or a Buick, something luxurious.
Sure, sure.
And they started the process to go south, but there were also 7 million other people on the roads. And people knew that they were rich Parisian Jews, and they would slam on the car. And they had to carry weapons because, you know, they could have been robbed or worse.
Sure, yeah.
It was a very tense time in France.
And where did they go when they left? Left their home.
They were on the road for maybe a month, and they eventually ended up taking shelter on a farm outside a small village called Nemours, and eventually made it to a suburb of Lyon called Villeurbanne, which is a suburb of Lyon. Lyon, most Americans might not know, was the capital of the French resistance at the time. And when the Germans took control of the southern zone, Vichy, in 1942, they really put the clamps on those people. They tried to starve them, and people were eating pets, dead horses. It was an awful time.
Yeah.
And she talks about living for years on soggy vegetables and thin soups, barely enough calories to stay alive. And people were more people died of starvation than bullets during that time. Hmm.
You know, if that's the one thing you notice from this book, Dennis, from Mademoiselle Gysi, is that it was a good refresher for me about that time and what that was like for people. You not only find out about this woman and her family, but you really get a sense of – you did a good job with that, of, you know, giving people a sense of what life was like during that time.
I was really fortunate to find some diaries of an English professor who had taught at the University of Lyon. And that was like an incredible window into that time period. And since it was written in English, I speak French, I read French, but it was still an incredible advantage.
Yeah, yeah.
In my research. That was the diamond in the rough for that novel.
Shea Giselle, the theater production, which picks up, I mean, that's after she's already been living here and she opens her club. The one thing that I remember, Dennis, is when you first did that, and that was you did that in May, June of 2010.
Right.
And that was also done at Cité des Arts. And the one thing that struck me about that production, and I was there as an audience member, when the intermission came, there were people in the audience who had not seen each other since they had become friends through her club. And people were cutting across the seats to get to the other side of the theater to give hugs and, oh my gosh, how are you? Is it you? Is it? And it was so – I never got up during that intermission because it was so interesting to just sit and eavesdrop on the conversations that were happening and people talking about their lives, talking about her back then. And then that picked up after the production was over with too. That was a fascinating part. I mean, that was a production in itself.
That's true. That did occur in so many ways, so many levels. There was a couple that came from New Orleans, and they had actually met in Shea Giselle in 1969.
Wow.
And they are still together. They have a museum in the French Quarter called the Burgundy House. And they contacted me and said they were coming. So it was a pleasure to meet them. But it was amazing to think that the relationship had survived all the years and that they met in Shea Giselle.
Yeah. And what was interesting listening to people talk that night was the place in history that her venue had for this area and in many people's lives. And that was, you know, although that is covered in the theater, you couldn't top what happened during that intermission. I mean, it was fascinating.
Everybody who might have went to the club in those years was very bonded to Gysi. And recently a man from California contacted me and he told me this story that he was with Tony and the Soul Survivors. And he was supposed to play a gig in St. Martinville and the club burned down a week before New Year's Eve. Well, they called and the booking agent called and said, we've got this gig at this club. And if you don't bother them, they won't bother you. So he gets there. He's only 17.
Yeah.
And he's noticing all these beautiful women walking around. And one of them, a beautiful blonde, comes up and talks to him. And she's got a voice like a trucker.
And that was an eye-opening world experience for him.
He said everybody was so nice, and they played several gigs after that. And he said the one thing he remembered is every band would play, and the audience would applaud and give their approval. And Giselle was placed almost in a throne chair on the stage.
Yeah.
And everybody would then turn at the end of the performance and wait for her to give a nod and a smile that she approved the act.
That's great. Did how did he know to contact you? Did he find out you were putting the production together, or
his ex-wife is Miss Hannah in this production?
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
Camilla Moutal. Yeah, you heard from other people also from that time period who contacted you after the first production came out?
Tons, and that's really what precipitated my idea of writing a book about Giselle's life. And when I started digging, I thought the Warriors were going to be maybe three chapters. And that turned into being a 370-page book of historical fiction. So now I'm writing I Heart Gigi, which is her life in America.
Yeah, because the first book
all takes place in France.
Yeah. And so now you're on the second one.
Right.
How far are you into the process?
50,000 words, which is about half of a 350-page
book. Thank you, because I have no idea with that. So that's 50,000 words is about half of a 300-page book.
350-page book.
Okay. Yeah. How do you write, Dennis? Do you use a computer? Do you do pen to paper?
I use a computer in Word. I get up every day at 6 and try to start my writing at 7, and I write till 5 o'clock every day.
It's
like my job.
Yeah, that's your work time. Interesting. For the second book that you're writing, is it again going to be another historic fiction, that style?
It's probably technically not historical fiction because you have to be in the time period of having 50 years.
Oh, got it. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So technically it's not historical fiction, but it is fiction. I would really term this book, second book, as themed chick lit or a woman's story.
Chick lit, is that? No, I didn't know that. That's a term that's used for women's
literature.
Huh.
That appeals maybe more to women.
Okay.
I mean, yes, it is about a woman who had a gay bar, but the story is a lot about her family too and how she got there, because she really didn't plan on having a gay bar and it just kind of happened. And so once she reaches the years of having the gay bar, yes, it is, the setting is Chez Giselle. But it's also other stories that are happening in the background. I don't want to divulge too much.
Yeah.
But there's a bit of a romance. And
fun. As I had mentioned earlier, to find out more about Dennis and his writings, you can go to Dennis Ward. Let's see.
Author.com.
Yeah, Dennis Ward, author.com. You can also find him on Facebook. And I would encourage people to read those short stories also. They're wonderful and written. It doesn't matter where you grew up. It takes you back, you know, especially the Higgins Lake, takes you back to a time, when you were a kid. And also Mademoiselle Gigi, which is available now through a number of different avenues. And then we have I Heart Gigi, which is going to be the next one coming out. But you do have Chez Giselle, which is opening this Thursday, which is also the opening of the Acadiana Pride Festival.
That's right. I was really honored they chose my play to open the festival.
And that's Ted Richard, who's really –
he's
doing a ton of work on
producing the play, and they have the 3-day event. So come down to downtown this weekend.
And you're going to be there this Thursday also.
Yes. Yes, I will be signing books. I'm going to do a presentation of Giselle and my story and the book and so forth. So it'll start at 6 o'clock, Cité des Arts.
Okay. And that actually is going to run through April 13th, although during those weekend runs, this will be the only Thursday that it runs. Otherwise,
that's
it's
right.
Friday, Saturday, and then doing a Sunday matinee.
Right.
And to contact Cité, you can go to their website at citedesarts.org, and that's DESARTS.org. Dennis, thank you for coming on today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's
yeah.
been a pleasure.
We're going to go out with a song that brings back a lot of different memories for a lot of people, but that I Will Survive was a special song for Gigi.
Yeah, it's kind of her anthem, her theme song.
All right. Everybody have a good week. Get up and dance a little bit when this one comes on.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong. And I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. And so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just one second you'd be back to bother me. Oh, now go, walk out. You're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? You think I'd grumble? You think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll be alive. I've got all my life to live. I've got all my love to give. And I'll survive. I will survive. Hey.
I'm Ira Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Thursday night at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, host of Louisiana Eats. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 4 p.m. for your weekly serving on KRVS 88.7 FM, listener-supported public radio for Acadiana.
Regional Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS-FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.